Andrew Solomon is with us here on the Paula Gordon Show, as is Bill Russell, of course. Before Bill Russell picks up, he wants to so badly, I got a sense of the powerful puritanical condition in which America in particular still lives, and much of the Western world, that we should just buck up, and after a while you should get off your medicine, and there's this peculiar social pressure to just get on with it, and whistle while you work, and be positive, and don't tell me about it. Did this puritanical streak, am I making that up? It sounded to me like time and again you're fighting people who just were not going to accept this as part of the human condition, and we could do some things about it.
It was very interesting to me to find out what the origins of that are. In the ancient world, there was no particular stigma attached to depression, and people spoke about it as openly as they speak about headaches, and people were as sympathetic to it as they would be about any other serious ailment. In the Middle Ages, St. Augustine separated illnesses of the body from illnesses of the soul, and mental illnesses were classed as illnesses of the soul. And if your soul was diseased, that was a mark of God's disfavor. And so people began being very secretive about those illnesses and trying to cover them up. And then in the Inquisition, if you suffered from depression, that was seen as a sign that you had despaired of ultimate redemption, which meant that you were not a good or religious person, and you could be imprisoned or even executed simply for being depressed. And so at that point, people began to be very secretive, and this whole stigma grew up. And that stigma has stuck around, so that even though we're no longer subject to Augustine's or the Spanish Inquisition's set of rules on these things, the stigma is still there, and the sense that people have to just somehow get through things and not show any of this weakness remains extremely strong.
Which is also why you wrote a whole chapter on the history, isn't it?
It is, exactly.
Well, and this, I think there's still a general sense that this is a character issue.
Yes.
I mean, I get sad, I get over it. What's your problem?
Mm. There's a question of weakness and strength, yeah, and a suggestion that strong people don't become depressed. Though, in fact, my experience is that many people who become depressed have to build up an enormous inner strength in order to remain alive and to get through their depression, which is completely unknown to people who don't encounter any of these psychological difficulties.
Don't leave that yet. There's a sense that one can partner with depression, that it isn't just something to get over and to cope with and get behind you, or even to put aside, one really can treat this as a positive part of life, even though it is incredibly painful.
Well, what I would say is perhaps the great point of the book that I've written is to show how people manage to find meaning in depression. It seems to me that nobody would or should choose to have a depression for its enriching value. If you have a choice in the matter, don't have a depression.
Just pass on that one.
If you have to have a depression, then it's important that you not close yourself off from the experience of that depression, that you instead try to look into what's happened and try to find out what you've learned from it and try to find out in what ways it's fulfilling or enriching or has given you an understanding of emotion you didn't previously have. And I found that a lot of the people I interviewed said, while I was in my depression, if you had said to me that I was really going to learn from this and get great beneficial things from it, I would have thrown you out of the room if I'd had the energy to do it or kicked you down the stairs. But now that it's over, I recognize that I grew in certain ways by going through it. And I think those ways have been extremely valuable. And I'd like to try to lead people into that sense of value from their own depression, because people who are able to say, who I am now is someone who was formed partly by depression, and I'm pleased with who I am now, and I therefore acknowledge a certain debt to the depression, are people who can go on and have rather happy and fulfilled times. And people who say, I lost 10 years out of my life having this terrible depression, and it was a barren, empty, horrible, hollow thing, have got a great burden of pain and anger that I think continues to afflict them, and that in fact makes it more likely that they'll relapse back into depression.
So we do have some control in this process.
Yes.
You talk quite eloquently about learning how to think about thinking.
I think that one of the things that's happening in our society right now is that people are medicalizing depression and then treating it with antidepressants and treating it only with antidepressants. I believe, actually, in approaching it from as many different angles as possible, but I think part of what should happen often in the context of talking therapies, though also to some extent just in the course of reading great books on the subject and considering it oneself and thinking about it, is that when it comes to a complex integrated sense of oneself and of what the depression has meant to one, and I think that when we try to treat depression simply and we oversimplify it, that we become ineffective in our treatment of it.
I think culturally we all are numerosophists.
He made it up, he did.
We all believe in the power of numbers, and you early on in your survey, your atlas, you try to address some of those number issues, because the first question, of course, is how many people suffer from depression? And the fact that we have a definitional issue complicates that, of course, but that doesn't seem to deter a lot of people.
Oh, I love your line that the more rigid the number, the less it tells you.
Mm.
But the, I guess to get, sort of get a hand around it, and part of the reason I ask is this has been an immensely successful book. It's been translated into many, many languages, 20 plus. It's available all over the world. It's won prizes.
National
people
Book
read
Award.
It. You know, all of which you're smiling. You like that, don't you?
This part is good.
Which says that there is an interest of some sort. Is it voyeuristic, or is, you know, is 85% of the population suffering from either depression or incipient depression? But I ask all that just to get a sense of the scale of what we're talking about.
My experience is that most people have either experienced depression themselves or had a close connection to someone who's experienced depression. Almost anyone I meet to whom I say I've written a book about depression says to me, oh God, I had this terrible thing 8 years ago, or you know, I've had an ongoing problem, or my sister committed suicide, or I have this cousin who I've been really worried about, or there's someone who sits next to me at work. People just have some connection to the subject. So while I think that those numbers are tricky, the number that I gave at the beginning of the book is that about 3% of Americans suffer from some form of chronic depression. And I think that's roughly accurate. I think there are more than 3% who have got some symptoms of depression, and that only a small part of that 3% are completely crippled and disabled by what they have. This is the dimensional part of the discussion, that there are different degrees of depression, different kinds of depression. But I think that depression touches directly or indirectly really almost everyone.
And part of the challenge is even knowing that you have it.
Yes.
It's not like coming down with a flu, where it's more or less unambiguous, and you can send a blood sample off, and it comes back from the lab and says, you got the flu, son. This is much more complicated than that.
I think lots of people look forward to a time when we'll have brain scans which can accurately show exactly where a particular person's depression lies. And
yeah,
can
but,
say,
there are, but there's
you have
also
a lot of deactivation or a lot of this, that, or the other thing. But at this point, we work on the basis of people's individual descriptions of symptoms. If you have these negative feelings which are preventing you from functioning, then you have some kind of depression. And if they aren't preventing you from functioning, then maybe you don't. And when you say, you know, if you have brain cancer and then one day you wake up and you say, gee, I feel better today, the doctor can say, well, I'm glad you feel better, but there's still a tumor there and it's still growing and, you know, you'll still probably die from it. If you have depression and then you wake up one day and you feel better, since depression is an illness of how you feel, you don't have depression anymore. And it's very confusing to think this can be there, it can go away, it can come back. It's a very chaotic
Well, and it seems, as you report it, to have a, how to say, a substantial cultural dimension. There, as you describe, it seems that there's some cultures, some circumstances under which people, rather than manifesting mental symptoms, if you will, that they somatize it, that they develop headaches or chronic problems with their arms hurting or their legs hurting or those kinds of things, which makes it extraordinarily complicated to even figure out what we're talking about, doesn't it?
Well, we'll figure out what we're talking about in just a moment. We know that we're talking with Andrew Solomon.
He knows. I'm asking.
We know we're talking about work that he has reported in a wonderful book called The Noonday Demon, An Atlas of Depression. And we know that we'll be back shortly with The Paula Gordon Show. We hope you'll be with us.